Paul McCartney are among the items going up for auction at a major music artifact sale. Julian's Auctions announced today that the June event will include a 1984 Blue Cloud guitar custom made for Prince and the lyrics for Maxwell's Silver Hammer. I'm Ann Cates.
Please listen. This is important. Anyone can be affected by the prescription opioid crisis. If you think you've been hurt by Purdue or its prescription opioids like OxyContin, you may be entitled to compensation as part of Purdue's bankruptcy, but you have to file a claim. Claims may include overdose, death, substance use disorder, lost wages, and neonatal
Born with News Radio 1240 KQEN and these headlines. Ballots are arriving for the May primary election. All Costco stores, including the one in Roseburg, is requiring customers to wear a face covering that covers the nose and mouth at all times. They have returned to their regular hours of operation. For more information, visit 541radio.com. Chance of showers today, cloudy and 47 for a low. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and 73 degrees expected. I'm Ashley Claiborne with News Radio 1240 KQEN.
The following program is paid for by CHI Mercy Health Mercy Medical Center. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Each weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now, Talking Health, presented by CHI Mercy Health. Now, here's Talking Health with Lisa Platt on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon. Thanks for being here. We continue our series looking at public health in Douglas County, all related to the COVID-19 situation. Kyle Bailey hosting the program for now. Lisa Platt will be back soon when we get back into our regular programming for Talking Health. We're joined again by Douglas County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Laura Turpin, an epidemiologist for the Douglas Public Health Network. Thanks for being on with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
So, Dr. Bob, first of all, we have a number of things to cover today, but let's first of all paint an in-depth picture as to where we stand on the COVID-19 situation, starting at the world level and working our way back to Douglas County.
Well, at the world level, it still is pretty grim. There's lots and lots of cases around each year. Every day when we look, there's more and more. We're seeing throughout the world well over 3 million cases and really a quarter of a million deaths. So really has been quite worrisome. And what's worrisome is we're starting to see big increases in cases in places all around the world, Brazil, Russia, Bangladesh, in Peru. So it really is all over the world here, and that's a bit worrisome because even if we get it under control in one area with international travel, this is going to continue to spread. In the United States, we're still seeing quite a few cases, although I think we're over that first peak. There are some states that are opening up, and we'll get a chance to see then whether when we open up we're going to have more cases. In Oregon, we still have had just a moderate number of cases, a relatively low attack rate, and in Southern Oregon, even a lower attack rate than that. In Douglas County, we've been sort of stuck at 24 cases for a while. Most of our cases have now recovered, so only have 6 active cases and still just one person in the hospital. So as you look at the world, it's pretty grim and gets better as we focus in.
Now, obviously, there's been a ramp back of travel. I'm not exactly sure what travel is going on in other parts of the world. I'm more familiar with what's happening in the U.S., where hardly anything is moving airwise. And yet, you're seeing the virus pop up in these new hotspot areas. Talk about how that takes place.
So what we think is that the virus was pretty much spread around in January and February. And what we're starting to see now is we're starting to see exponential growth of the virus in those areas. So we think it had been in Russia all along. And what we're seeing now is that cases are being more and more recognized, and we're starting to see more hospitalizations and deaths in those areas.
So is it more that, not so much that more cases are there, but more they're just being more easily recognized by the health officials in those areas?
So it probably is a combination of both. So they're probably both more cases and more awareness.
Interesting. Now, at the U.S., I know last week you talked about some areas that had particular, hotspot areas. What are those this week?
Well, the hotspots of the country now appear to be in the heart of the country. Iowa has had the worst in the last week, but we've seen big increases in the Dakotas. We've seen big increases in Kansas. And so we're starting to see that these really are just spreading throughout the country.
Now, in Oregon, I believe we've gone 2 days in a row with no deaths being reported.
So the number of deaths in Oregon is lower. The number of new cases and severe cases is lower. What we think we're doing now is we're finding more and more of the mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic people, and that's why the cases keep increasing, but the number of hospitalizations and deaths is going down.
And as well, starting today, the Oregon Health Authority, when they put out their daily statewide update, are listing cases that have tested positive through the actual test and cases that are now considered to be presumptive positive and are being monitored. What do you know about the reason for the change and just how the data is being put out?
So as new diseases come out, we learn more about the diseases, and then we come up with new definitions as they go on. In the past, we only considered a case to be when you actually had a positive molecular test. That's a positive nasal swab that then does a PCR and you get the positive test. What we've recognized is that everybody else in the family has it, and you come up with an illness that's like it, you likely have it. It would be unlikely that three people in the family would have the disease and the other person would have pneumonia and it would be something else. So those are now considered to be presumptive cases. We think that many of those presumptive cases will get reclassified as confirmed cases when the test comes back.
And once someone is deemed presumptive positive, then I would presume they would be getting tested ASAP.
We would hope so. Now, sometimes that cannot happen for various reasons. For example, if somebody dies, obviously you're not able to do a test while they're alive. But you know that we hope that most of those cases will get tested.
Now, going back to January, when you first saw this coming and we're looking at all the data that's available to public health folks, has this been worse than you thought it would be, at least in the U.S., let's say? Or would it? Is it about what you expected, or is it not as bad?
This is almost exactly what we'd expected. I actually re-listened to our talk back in January, and the predictions back in January were remarkably accurate in what we predicted. We were predicted that at least for the flu season, flu would be worse than coronavirus, but that coronavirus could be a long-lasting thing that we're going to deal with, and that's exactly how it's turned out.
It's interesting to monitor this and watch it. For a lot of people, it's less it's the health issue, but a lot of people who don't have it in their family or their friends don't know of anyone who has had it or has passed away. There's a lot of other things they're worried about, but it's been interesting to talk to people around our area and a number of folks that I happen to know personally who have had family members in other states, other parts of the country, impacted by the virus. For many people, it's not as far away as they maybe wish it was.
Well, you know, we in Douglas County have been fairly lucky, right? We have had very few hospitalizations and no deaths. However, I think if you're in New York, where I grew up, you'd know a lot of people who either had it and or died. You know, as I said to other people, the hospital that I was born in, which is Wyckoff Heights Hospital in New York, has had a terrible time of it. In fact, on the street, right next to the street where we lived, there's a row of refrigerator trucks for the dead bodies.
Wow. It's very grim to look at it and to look at some of the data. I haven't looked at the John Hopkins site recently. I presume you probably check that about every day.
Well, every couple of hours.
Wow. And talk about what's available on that site. You could probably explain it better than I can.
So you can find this in many ways. So what I look for is the number of new cases per day, the deaths as compared to the number of cases. So, you know, we think the mortality on this virus is only a couple of percent, probably 1 to 4 or 5%. What we're seeing as a death rate now in some areas is far higher than that, 8 or 10 or 12%, suggesting that we're missing a lot of cases. You know, if you look at New York, for example, their positive test rate is about 20%. If you have a positive test rate of 20%, you're not nearly doing enough tests. And so this is far worse than even the numbers show.
What are you seeing nationally? Let's start there in terms of a ramped up testing capacity. Are things starting to move that direction?
Well, I think they're starting to move that direction. What we saw in other places when they got this under control, they were able to do enough tests that they really could find almost every case. And the way to do that is you need to do enough testing that your negative rate is very high. So here in Douglas County, our negative rate is 98%. So only 1 or 2% of the tests we do are positive, suggesting we're probably testing about the right number of people. But again, in New York, you'd have to do 20 times as many tests to get their positive rate down to 1%. So I think we in Oregon are doing a better job than many other places. But the reason we're able to do a better job is because we've just not had a lot of cases.
From the public health standpoint, do you think once we get through all of this or get through the first wave of it or however it ends up shaking out, that we'll look down the road and decide that more resources need to be allocated to be ready for things like this?
Well, I think this is clearly an eye-opener that pandemics are one of the biggest risks, and I think others have recognized this in the past. I was looking at an article today on Lori Garrett, who's somebody who predicted this years and years ago, that pandemics could happen, and certainly it's been in the popular movies. Contagion, epidemic, all those movies suggested that these things could happen. And it is a shame that we weren't a little bit better prepared.
And it seems like, much like the movies, there's elements of this situation that nobody ever expected to have happen again. You know, people around a community and masks and all the safety protocols that are now beginning to be put in place in various arenas. I mean, that in itself, if you back up 4 months, almost looks like a movie set too.
It does. I mean, there are a bunch of things now that you couldn't really imagine. If in February I come on the show and said, look, there's going to be no basketball playoffs. There's going to be no March Madness. There's not going to be any baseball season. There's going to be no graduations. And basically all of the planes in the country are going to be grounded. You would have considered me loony. But I think right now we're seeing things which we could never have imagined.
Wow. And I'm sure as a health professional, you've talked about some of these other pandemics before, and certainly 1918 and ones like that, and probably looking back to read reports from that time and see what you can learn.
So 1918 is instructive. Now, it was a very different pandemic. That was influenza, a disease for which much of the world had some immunity. And in fact, in the 1918 pandemic, not very many seniors died in that pandemic because they think 30 years or so before that, there had been an influenza that most of the old people had had and had some immunity to. The other thing with flu is it's got a relatively short incubation period, and at the time, we didn't have fast travel. So we just had train travel at the time, which was still pretty fast and still really spread. But I think now with plane travel, with the fact that this has got a longer incubation period and there's no baseline immunity, this is a really tough one.
County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer with us. Laura Turpin, epidemiologist for the Douglas Public Health Network as well. We're going to continue in just a moment. Turn to Laura and talk about testing, contact tracing, and more. On Talking Health and Felice Applied, I'm Kyle Bailey, 419 on News Radio 1240 KQEN. Back in 2 minutes.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon 422, Douglas County's news team. The afternoon report coming up at 5. Keep your radio on. Keep checking 541radio.com, the 541 Radio app, and the KQEN Facebook page for information all day long and every day of the week. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and epidemiologist Laura Turpin of the Douglas Public Health Network. Laura, we're going to turn to you to start this segment along with Dr. Bob. And last Friday, actually, Governor Kate Brown laid out some plans towards the reopening. And one of the things she talked about was wanting many more people to be doing contact tracing and gathering data, put some standards together for this. Laura, what are you hearing about this and how this could be rolled out?
So we have like we've talked about before, an epi strike team here in Douglas County ready to interview contacts in the event that we have a surge. And we are hearing that we might be receiving additional support from the Oregon Health Authority for additional contact tracers. I believe they estimated we would need 15 per 100,000, so we would be getting about 15.
So that would be 10 more people working on this.
Right, and we would hope that it would be a diverse mix of people, including possibly some people will help us reach everybody in the county.
So you're trained in this. I mean, you're an epidemiologist all the time, but how do you pull to do this? What kinds of requirements, what kinds of health experience or knowledge, what do they have to be involved?
Well, they'll be doing some online training, and I think that they're looking at people who have a background either in healthcare or have worked with people. We can do on-the-spot training on motivational interviewing, and there will be some social services support aspect to it as well. So sometimes people might need connection to resources like food or housing or mental health support. And so we would be connecting them to resources as well.
So if you are able to get these extra folks in Douglas County, are you working on a structure in terms of where they could be working from and different logistical things like that?
Sure. So ideally they would be working remotely. So far our Epi Strike team members have been, and that is preferable. You know, there's no reason to put us all in one office because we are calling people remotely anyway. So we could be in different locations, even working from home.
And Dr. Bob, we've talked about this before. It's amazing the areas of medicine where people have embraced telehealth now because they had to and maybe weren't so enthused about it before.
Well, telehealth really has worked out much better than I would have predicted, and so we're working on that. There are still some things far better to do in person, but much of what we can do over the phone. And for the Epi Strike team, they're going to be checking on people and their symptoms. And with the new medical equipment, so for example, people have the disease, we'll actually give them an oximeter to use at home, and they can measure their oxygen levels and read it out and tell us what their oxygen levels are. A digital thermometer, they can take their temperature and tell us what that is. We can figure out what the respiratory rate is. So while not quite as good as seeing them, you can really get a lot of information over the phone.
So, Laura, will the folks that are working remotely, when, as Dr. Bob just mentioned, when there is a need to interact with these people or get them towards testing, will there be any going out to meet with them? How will that be handled?
Well, we are still parsing out the details, but I don't think there'll be any contact whatsoever between contact tracers and the patients. Preferably, we would be doing this over the phone. The exceptions to this might be if somebody does not have a phone or have access to that. We've done field visits for other types of diseases before, and in this case, we would just be wearing proper PPE or keeping a safe distance.
And then obviously communicating with them if you want them to go in and have a test, et cetera. Is there any scenario where you have folks, and I'm thinking maybe older folks in particular, that are generally at home anyway, is there any way for the test to come to them, or is that too complex?
We haven't had to do that so far. We've been able to partner with medical transport companies. We're doing our drive-through, so we would prefer for people to come through our drive-through. But we do have the capacity, if necessary, to test somebody at their home if needed.
And
we also have the ability to transport them.
Okay. Dr. Bob, speaking of testing, I wanted you to maybe explain the difference between the PCR nasal swab testing and the antibody test. It seems like there's a lot of confusion about that.
Oh, my goodness, there's lots of confusing. So let me see if I can explain it. So there's two tests. The first is a molecular test, and that's a test that actually looks for the DNA that's in the virus itself. And so that is the one we do typically with a nasal swab, although there are some new tests out there using either nasal swabs from the front of the nose or even saliva. But what that actually looks for is that actually looks for the RNA that's part of the virus. And so it's a very accurate test if there is virus there. It's very specific, meaning that there's almost never any false positives, but it does require a tremendous level of detail. So I explained the molecular test to be similar to having a book, having the pages in the book, looking at all the words that are in that book,
and then finding the specific words that are in that book. So if, for example, you pick the Bible, right, you'd have in the beginning. And so if you found the words in the beginning and then a bunch of other passages, you'd be sure that that was the Bible. Think of how incredibly complicated that is to do. And so the PCR test is a great test. We've only had them out since I've been a doctor. And so they're very, very accurate, but they do take some time and they require a lot of really detailed stuff to get them done. The antibody test is a test to see if your body makes antibodies against the virus. It's a blood test, and it looks for antibodies, which are the immunoglobulins, which show you may have had the disease. Now, they're much less specific, because when your body makes antibodies, it makes antibodies specifically against viruses, but the antibodies that it makes against one virus can be similar to the antibodies it makes against a different virus. And so the antibody test is a test to see if you have antibodies against the disease that are there. And the problems with the advantage of the antibody test is it is positive after you're done. So after you've had this disease, you will have antibodies there. So I had measles as a kid, so if you measured my blood, I'd have measles antibodies. And so that's the advantage of it. The disadvantage is it is neither that sensitive nor specific. So, again, using the book analogy, it's do you remember asking me, my body, do you remember how the Bible starts? And so I may or may not remember exactly how it starts. And so the test is good in some ways, and it's good at a population level, but at an individual level, probably not as important as the molecular test.
And how important is it that this testing is kept as consistent as possible?
Well, the problem with the antibody testing is that there are a bunch of new antibody tests out there, and they all vary. So one of the tests that they did was they looked at serum from people who donated blood back in July of 2018. Way before this virus was out there, so nobody should have antibodies against the COVID virus back from that serum. Yet when they tested it, some of the tests showed that 20% of the people turned positive. So that would be 20% of the people who we know didn't have COVID because their blood was drawn back in 18, yet showed a positive test. So there's all kinds of troubles with the antibody test. In fact, the FDA today basically put much stricter regulations on the antibody tests. And so the antibody tests are still not quite ready for prime time. Now, the one group that I would recommend get the test is people who thought they had the disease who are willing to donate convalescent plasma. So that is a group that might want to get antibody testing, because if they do have antibodies, they may be able to use their plasma to help people who are sick with the disease.
And explain why that's possible. What is it about the plasma of those folks that can be helpful?
So we think the people who've had the disease have antibodies and maybe other substances in the blood which can help to neutralize and treat this virus. And so it doesn't work for everything, but for many diseases, and for 100 years now, we've known that if you use the convalescent plasma of people who had the disease, it can help in treating disease. It's never magic, but it can certainly help.
Now, Laura, on Friday when the governor made her presentation talking about the importance of contact tracing and getting all these connections made, talk more about the process of that and how it works and what you think the importance is of doing what seems to be very methodical, a lengthy amount of work.
Right. So the process is when we get a new case, we call that patient, we do about an hour-long interview with them, and we identify every place that they've been and people that they might have been exposed. The new exposure definition is if somebody has been within 6 feet of that patient for 15 minutes. So that our new guidelines have greatly expanded the number of contacts that we will be notifying, hopefully people at home, and so they won't have that many contacts, but 15 minutes is a pretty short amount of time. And so we make a list of all those contacts, and then we go through them in order of high priority to low priority, notifying them, and now they'll have to stay home for 14 days and encouraging them to get tested if they develop symptoms.
So what's the reaction when you tell someone they've got to stay home for 14 days?
For the most part, people understand, and we go to great lengths to explain why we're doing this. The exception is for healthcare workers, depending on exposure, but for everybody else, that if you've been exposed to somebody with COVID-19, the guidelines recommend that they stay home for 14 days to watch for symptoms.
Now, if someone is told that and then is staying home, what about, for instance, a spouse or significant other that they've been around a lot? Does that person automatically be put in that classification as well?
They do not, unless that person then goes to develop symptoms. So if that first contact develops symptoms, then they become a presumptive case, and we would recommend that their contact stay home as well. So you can see how this can very quickly impact a lot of people. If somebody has five contacts, but then each of them also have five contacts, it can create a lot of public health work.
Well, and as well, if someone was in quarantine and there's someone else in their family, and people's housing situations vary depending on what size house or apartment they live in and all of that, the other folks, this seems like it could end up being a very complicated situation, certainly one that nobody would really want to be in.
Right, and for household members who are living with somebody sick with COVID-19, we recommend that they stay home until that patient has recovered for 72 hours without symptoms. So it can end up being quite a long time at home, but we have the resources to help them with grocery delivery if needed, or troubleshooting other problems that might come about having to stay home for that period of time.
Wow. I have thought through that just in terms of if it ever applied to me, how that would be handled. And it is certainly a very fascinating, a lot of ramifications. Going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about masks, unmasking masks, a lot of controversy, a lot of pushback about masks in some quarters, and a lot of support for masks in others. We'll get more about that when we come back. Talking Health, Kyle Bailey for Lisa Platt, County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, and epidemiologist Laura Turpin of the Douglas Public Health Network on News Radio 1240 KQEN. Back in 3 minutes.
Six. state of mind, it's a belief system that leads you to things. Think, do rich people stuff. Think like rich people. Learn how they think. And then make a decision to think like rich people. It'll change your life.
Weekdays from 5:30 to 7 on News Radio 1240 KPN. Now more than ever, you need accurate information, and that's what we provide. On the Morning, America's first news with Gordon Neal.
Join us weekdays at 6 a.m. and begin your day with in-depth news from around the nation and across the world. Our team talks with the newsmakers and those reporting the news. Follow the president, Congress, the economy, the world of business, and more. We have a few light moments, too. This Morning, America's first news with Gordon Neal. Just ahead of the Morning Report at 7 a.m. with the Douglas County's news team on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Kyle Bailey for Lisa Platt as we continue this series looking at COVID-19 and getting out public health information from the Douglas Public Health Network. Laura Turpin is an epidemiologist with that organization. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer with us as well. We're calling this segment Unmasking Masks. Dr. Bob, you've talked about masks every interview we've done about this. It was in a kind of an evolving situation. It's evolved further as we announced with our news today. Costco and Roseburg, part of Costco nationwide, now mandating customers to wear masks in their stores. And we've seen a lot of comment today to that announcement, a lot of pushback, a lot of back and forth, some people not being pleased with that at all, others very supportive of it. Talk more about kind of your perspective on masks.
Well, masks are literally changing every day. So just looked at a large study today on masks, and masks are probably useful in preventing the spread of a person who is sick or is getting sick. So what we know in this disease is that people who are asymptomatic or especially pre-symptomatic can definitely spread this disease to others and not even know about it, right? So if you're asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, you don't know you have the disease, and yet they can spread it to others. And so masks are very useful to prevent you from spreading it to others. They're probably a little effective in preventing you from getting it, but mostly effective in preventing you from giving it to others. So I heard somebody on TV yesterday saying, well, wearing a mask is a sign of respect, that I don't want to make you sick. That would be the reason to wear a mask. Now, again, 2 or 3 months ago, it would have been absolutely outrageous to suggest people would wear a mask shopping at Costco. But I think that's what we're going to see. I think we're going to see this as the new norm, that when you cannot maintain social distancing, that you wear a mask. So, for example, I know Aviva is having their workers use masks at work. I use my mask here all the time, and so it's just become a part of my outfit as I get out for the day.
Different types of masks. Run through that information again. There's still a lot of questions about that.
So the most protective kind of masks are the moon suits with that we use for our drive-through. Those are not particularly reasonable to be used through the day. Then there's N95 masks, which are the kind that we use in the ICU when we have people on ventilators who have COVID, when people have tuberculosis or measles. They are highly effective. They're in very short supply. They do require special fit testing before you use them. So they are not practical for the population. The next down are surgical or procedure masks. These do provide a fair amount of protection, but again, more protection for the person who's wearing the mask to not give it to someone else rather than to prevent them from getting an illness. And then we get down to cotton masks. And if you look at the relative efficiency, those masks that we wear at the fairgrounds are 99% effective. The N95 masks are 95% effective, surgical masks between 80 and 90% effective, and cloth masks that, like I'm wearing, would be about 60 to 80% protective.
And obviously, the more effective they are, the higher the cost and probably the shorter the supply.
The higher the cost, for example, those PAPRs that we use are about $1,500 each. So this would obviously not be practical for everyone to use. Cloth masks are relatively inexpensive. Typically, they can be made for less than $2.
Now, when you look at retail, a number of chains, Fred Meyer, which is part of Kroger, have been requiring all their workers to wear masks for a while. We're seeing that in other retail places as well, for the grocery and other type stores that are still open. In most cases, the companies are providing those for their workers. And now this move towards having more customers wearing them. And of course, the other thing as well, when you get all these folks that are around each other, even in a reduced capacity grocery store, now seeing numbers of people whose jobs are to simply just clean carts and things like that. Again, another element that 2 months ago wasn't there.
And so I think we're going to see the new normal. So we think after 9/11, the new, you know, before you could just walk into the, just walk onto your plane, and now there's that whole thing that we do at security where you show your ID and to walk through a metal detector or some other kind of detector, and they check your bags and whatever. And so these people did not exist before, and they exist now. And I think this is one of the things we're going to see. I think we're going to see increased attention towards cleaning things at the front of the store. I think you're going to start to see decreased capacity at the store. And so I think this is likely to be part of the new normal. Now, we've done this with travel in the TSA, and it makes travel a little less comfortable, but still people travel. And I think it's going to, and I think with this pandemic, these changes are going to make things a little different, but life will continue.
It's interesting, as you were explaining the differences relating to 9/11, I've been at the White House in a typical visitor tour twice. Once was before 9/11, once was three years after. And just being able to do that was very different. I recall the first time around, all you had to do was show up at a certain location in a green space area a few blocks from the Capitol and get in a line really early in the morning. And then you were handed a ticket that said come back at 10 o'clock or whatever. And now to get in, and it's just the open to the public visitor tour, you've got to go through a congressional office. There's a little bit of a background check process and all of that. And you have to be there at a particular time. And being around Washington, D.C. twice, I saw a lot of differences in a lot of places. And that was interesting to watch at the time. But now to think about sort of a similar differential between a couple months ago and the future, and the potential that some of this may be around for a long time, is probably unsettling for some people.
It will be unsettling because this will be a big difference, and it may increase our national efficiency a little bit. Obviously, those people are TSA, are additional people, and there's additional costs, but we've gotten through it, and I think we're to the other side of our worries about terrorism. We'll get to the other side of our worries about this pandemic also.
Now, one question I saw out there today related to maybe for some particular folks, are there drawbacks to wearing masks or especially wearing them too long?
So what we do worry about with masks is once they get wet from exhalation or whatever, they become less effective at blocking spray, as well as they're much more uncomfortable to wear. So we are recommending people to wear masks at times that they cannot enforce social distancing. Right now I'm sitting in my office, have a mask around my neck, but I have no reason to have it over my face. So we're asking people to do that. Now, what's really important is when you take it on and take it off, then you don't touch your face or your eyes, because we think that does have some risk.
Now, and I saw a term that I'd never heard of before, I may not even be able to say it right. Hypercapnia, can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so hypercapnia, so what happens is when people have something over their face, their breathing pattern changes, and some people, they breathe too much, hypercapnia, or some people breathe too little, and both of those can happen. We recognize this when people start getting full-face scuba masks. So scuba masks used to be just over your eyes, and then you'd have a separate thing in the mouth. But we recognize with full-face scuba or snorkel gear that some people have funny breathing things when you include your face in the breathing. So you do need to be careful. It's usually an uncomfortable feeling. So if you're wearing a mask and getting uncomfortable, get to a place where you can socially distance and take the mask off.
And can any long-term medical issues come from wearing these, especially if folks are in jobs where they've got to wear them all day, for instance, grocery store workers?
We have not noticed any, although that certainly could happen, but we've certainly not noticed any issues.
And do you think, what do you think now percentage-wise you're seeing out in the community wearing masks in closer proximity locations?
Well, I've been paying attention to this. I've been paying careful attention to this over the last month. I think it sort of peaked at about a third over this last week and is now still about a third. You've been out too. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it depends on where you go. A couple of the stores that I've been in, I would say probably Saturday or Sunday, it was probably 40% in one store and probably 50% in another store. I haven't been doing a lot of little shopping. John's trying to watch, trying to be kind of effective about how I do those. But you definitely, you see the difference. And the other thing that's interesting with a mask, you've talked about washing them. I've mentioned that to a number of people who've just looked at me and went, oh, I didn't think of that.
Yeah. Well, they should get washed. Just to be just like anything else you wear that touches your skin or touches your mouth. Probably don't want to be wearing the same underwear for weeks at a time. You probably don't want to be wearing the same mask more than a day or so at a time. So I've got about a dozen of them, and I just pick a new one each day.
Yeah, I'm up to three now, and I still marvel at the fact that I actually own three masks. Again, something else I wouldn't have expected even just a few weeks ago. Final segment when we come back. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, Laura Turpin, an epidemiologist from the Douglas Public Health Network. A two-minute break, then our final segment of Talking Health. Kyle Bailey for Lisa Platt on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Thanks for being here. 4:52, final segment with County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Laura Turpin, an epidemiologist with the Douglas Public Health Network. Dr. Bob, also an advisor to the governor's panel. What kinds of things have you been doing in that capacity in the past week?
Well, that group has been looking at things that we need to do to reopen Oregon. So that's a very good, very smart group looking at the criteria we need to get ready to help to reopen.
And did some of that shift at all after the governor's announcement on Friday, or was a lot of this kind of on the same pathway you'd already been going?
All the exact same path we've been going. So all of those things that she had talked about were things we had discussed.
And as you look at the data and the information, how likely is it, do you think, Douglas County could be part of the counties that would be allowed to move into phase one by potentially as early as May 15th?
Well, the virus will set the time frame, but I think if there's any place that's ready to go, I think Douglas County is one of the first areas. Again, we've had not very many new cases. We've got an excellent public health response. With the work of everybody else in the community, we've got lots of testing. And our PPE situation, while still a little tight, is better than most other places.
Now, starting on Friday, although in many cases really starting today, the non-urgent medical procedures, dentists, others, the hospital, et cetera, being able to slowly ramp back up, so a move forward for those folks.
Yeah, this is going to be a great move. I know there are some people who have delayed elective procedures, and I think the hospital is getting ready to go ahead and provide those services for people. So we're very excited about that.
Yeah, and for people, as we talked about with Jason Gray from Mercy last week in one of the midweek interviews, that elective procedure doesn't mean necessarily cosmetic procedure, but in some cases under this criteria, some folks were seeing medical conditions decline, et cetera, maybe an increase in pain or potential issues for the future. So I know they've got a whole criteria set up about what order they kind of do that in, but I think there was maybe a little misunderstanding that the type procedures were just things that were more cosmetic.
Yeah, I think cosmetic things will be still pushed back a little bit. But for example, there may be people who've had cancer, had an ostomy, and after a while you can take that ostomy down so you no longer have the ostomy bag. That would be considered elective surgery, but my goodness, if I had an ostomy, I'd want that done just as soon as possible. Or, for example, in a reconstructive surgery after breast cancer, I think people would want to get that done just as soon as they could. So that's the kind of stuff that they're going to be doing right off. The hospital doesn't do that much stuff, which is purely cosmetic. Most of the stuff the hospital does is really quite necessary.
So a big shift there, and we've seen the medical folks begin to ramp back up. And those experiences, because of all these social distancing guidelines, et cetera, in the near term and likely for much longer, are going to be very much different as well. One of our previous guests talked about, for instance, if you go to the dentist office, they may have you call in and sit in your car instead of waiting in the waiting room.
Right. So I think we're going to start to see packed waiting rooms, perhaps a thing of the past, and maybe that's a good sign. I think what we're going to see is that the dentists are going to be very careful, because remember, as the dentists work on you, they're using these extremely high-speed drills, or they're using the little sprayers that spray the teeth. That creates a lot of aerosol, and we think aerosol is a real risk. So the dentists are going to be taking a lot more precautions than they used to do, and they always took a lot of precautions. They're going to even be more careful now.
Laura, what can you tell folks about other things that Douglas Public Health Network is doing right now, working on this COVID-19 situation?
Well, we are working hard every day. We still have just a few sick at home patients at the moment, and so we are prepared moving forward.
Now, Dr. Bob, what about some of the other things that have been going on? Somebody asked me, and I actually didn't know, if you still have the hotline going that was around at the beginning of all this.
We do. So we've had our hotline open since the beginning of March, and that hotline continues. We're working 7 days a week. We moved it back to 8 to 5, and we have somebody asking questions. The number of questions has gone down, and I think that is a good sign, suggesting that we've answered most of the questions.
And what about your Facebook Live events?
We're doing it again tonight at 6 o'clock. This is a chance for people to ask their questions. And so what we're asking people to do is to listen to Facebook Live and put comments in the comments section, and I'll try to get to as many questions as we can get to. There's a bunch of things we'll cover tonight. I think we'll talk about antibody testing again. I think we'll talk about masks again.
And I think we're going to talk about remdesivir again.
And are you seeing new questions or just different people asking questions you've gotten before?
It's just amazing how many incredibly smart people there are out there who are asking all of these great questions, some of which I don't know the answers to. And if I don't know the answer to off the top of my head or through something I've read, then I look them up and answer them on the comments section of Facebook Live.
And as well, of course, the Douglas Public Health Network webpage, douglaspublichealthnetwork.org, that is available for folks as well. Looks like we're just about out of time. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Laura Turpin, an epidemiologist from the Douglas Public Health Network. Folks, thanks for being on again for another Talking Health program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that wraps it up for now. Back next week with Talking Health. The afternoon report coming up. Don't forget this interview at 541radio.com, a podcast available in just a few minutes.
The preceding program was paid for by CHI Mercy Health Mercy Medical Center. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.